Welcome back to Season 2 of the Clean Water Pod, the show about the challenges and successes in restoring and protecting water quality. My name's Jeff Berkus, and I'm talking to dedicated professionals across the country to build an understanding of how policy and science work together to meet the goals of the Clean Water Act for fishable, swimmable, and drinkable water quality in our nation's waters. To help us in our exploration of all things nutrients and water quality, this month we're going to head up to Cape Cod in Massachusetts. Today you're going to hear from Jennifer of Barnstable Clean Water Coalition, Aaron Perry of Cape Cod Commission, and Sarah Wigington of Massachusetts Alternative Septic System Test Center. Jennifer is going to give a high-level overview of the project. She's going to talk a little bit about a cranberry bog to wetland restoration project. That's really interesting. Aaron's going to expand a little bit on Jennifer's interview, give us a little bit more detail on some of the specifics of the project. And then Sarah is going to add, I think, a really interesting element on alternative to septics and alternative septic systems, and I think some really fascinating potential future approaches to waste management that we have not covered yet. So make sure you stick around for her interview as well. I did want to make sure I covered one term that's used in this episode that many of us may not be familiar with, and that's the word embayments. Simply put, an embayment is a recess in a coastline that forms a bay. So the watershed that drains to that bay and the tidal influences of the ocean, those are things that water quality professionals are going to need to take into account when they work in these water bodies. So I just wanted to make sure I established what that word is up front in case you heard it and were like, what in the heck is that? So without further delay, let's get into these interviews and talk about water quality in Cape Cod.
Good morning. My name is Jennifer Loughran, and I'm with Barnstable Clean Water Coalition, and I am one of the project managers there.
Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us on the Clean Water Pod.
Well, thanks for having me this morning, Jeff.
All right. Before we get into the project, before we talk about what's going on in Cape Cod and all the cool stuff you're doing, I want to talk about Jennifer first. So, Jennifer, where did you grow up and how did you get into water quality and what does this water body mean to you?
Oh, wow. Well, I am a native New Englander. I grew up in Massachusetts. But as soon as I graduated from college, I started exploring different parts of New England. I lived in Connecticut for a while. I lived in Rhode Island for a while. I moved a little while into Texas during my career with a large insurance company. And then at one point, I decided to get into the nonprofit space. And I was working with a health organization raising awareness about a cancer disease. And then when I moved to the Cape, a place that I truly love, I've been coming to Cape Cod for almost 30 years now. I decided to move here 7 years ago. So staying in the nonprofit space, I found a wonderful organization to work for called Barnstable Clean Water Coalition, whose mission is to restore and preserve water quality in Barnstable, one of the 15 towns of Cape Cod, but the work we do doesn't have any boundaries. It can help anywhere that has water quality challenges and issues.
Well, it's great. So you came into water quality a little later in your career.
Absolutely.
Did you have a background in water quality at all, or is this a passion project for you?
No, this was, I moved to the Cape thinking we had pristine waters here. Like I said, I've been coming up here for several years, always swam in these beautiful waters, did boating, which I still do, kayaking, a little bit of fishing. And when I moved here, I started meeting people and learning that what I thought was a beautiful environment to continue doing these activities. Actually, I was alarmed to learn that over the past 20, 30 years, we've actually been doing much harm to our coastal environments, our ponds and our lakes here on Cape Cod.
Let's talk about Barnstable Clean Water Coalition. So tell me a little bit more about what that coalition means, who's involved in this, and then what's the mission statement for this organization?
Sure. So Barnstable Clean Water Coalition is a nonprofit. We're a 501c3. We've been operating under an organization. Our 501c3 is actually called Three Bays Preservation. which was established in 1996. Its mission was primarily to protect a barrier island, which is right off of Osterville and Kituit, two of the villages of Barnstable. It's a barrier island called Dead Neck Samson's Island. It's an island that we co-own with Mass Audubon, whose their mission is to preserve the shoreline birds that are actually nest on Dead Neck Samson's Island. So we've had a partnership with them for several years as co-owners. But we've actually, about 6 years ago, under the new leadership of Z Crocker, our executive director, we started taking a different focus of looking at nature-based solutions to address our water quality issues here, primarily in Barnstable, as we said before, that expands across Cape Cod. So our mission is to restore and preserve water quality here on the Cape.
So let's talk about the Cape a little bit in terms of, you know, some of the challenges. So the season's all about nutrients. So, too many nutrients coming in, but what's the backstory there? You know, how long has there been an issue and, you know, where are we at in terms of progress?
Yeah. So one of the things that's very attractive about Cape Cod is just our environment, how beautiful it is here. We have our oceans. We have almost 1,000 ponds and lakes here. So we are known as a tourist and recreation vacationing kind of place for people. Then in the 1950s or so, this was an area that people said, well, I just don't want to go vacation there. I want to go live there. And so all of a sudden this building boom happened. Houses were starting to be built here. Businesses were starting to be formed here. So we went from a very open space where people were little cottages and shanties were, and smaller homes were here for people to come here to vacation, hotels and, you know, restaurants and such. But then all of a sudden, this area became very residential and very commercial. And right now we don't have very much open space left here on Cape Cod. So what does that mean? When you have businesses and homes built here, what comes with that? What comes with that is septic systems. And what that means is that we have wastewater going into our groundwater. The tidal kind of septic systems that we use here on Cape Cod is called Title V septic systems. And they were never developed in a way to take nutrient load, which is primarily in the form of nitrogen and phosphorus. And those two elements are really do a lot of great harm to what's going into our groundwater. So the nutrients that are coming out of our home right now is actually what's very harmful in causing harmful algae blooms and gradual eutrophication of all of our water bodies here on the Cape, so in our lakes, in our ponds. So over the past, I want to say, decade or so, people that have gone out kayaking in their ponds, they're starting to see like a green slime and bluish, greenish algae that's on the surface. Right now, we've had lots of closing of our ponds or warnings that people shouldn't use their ponds or their little dogs shouldn't go out there and lick water from the ponds because we have these very toxic algae blooms that are being formed. And where's that coming from? It's the wastewater that's coming out of our houses. That's 80% of the problem. 20% of the problem is the fertilizers that we're putting on our lawns and stormwater runoff. So about 80% is coming from our septic system, 20% from stormwater and fertilizer.
Oh, it's great. That's a great summary. And that's all, you know, real population based, right? I mean, in other watersheds, you have, you know, an agricultural component a lot of times, but this sounds like a very urbanized issue, even if you may not consider this area urban. It certainly is with 225,000 people, across that area. So that's very interesting. What are we doing on Cape Cod to try to address those two issues?
Yes. Yeah, so over the past 2 years, the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection, so I'll refer to them as MassDEP. MassDEP is really our agency in the Commonwealth that protects our health. And having clean drinking water and having a place to be able to recreate, it kind of falls under the domain of MassDEP. And MassDEP, one of the regulations that they have in place, and they have many regulations, one of them is the Title V regulations for septic systems. So over the past couple of years, with a lot of pressure coming from the harmful algae blooms and other things that are harming our waterways right now, MassDEP has been put to task on what they can do to address the problem. And part of that is changing the regulations of that they have for Title V. And there's really two fundamental things that have come out of recent regulation changes that were implemented in July of 2023. And one of those is this designation of what they call nitrogen-sensitive areas. Nitrogen-sensitive areas is what they've outlined on the Cape as which ones are having the most impact with nutrient overload. And if you took a look at the map for these NSAs, nitrogen-sensitive areas, it's pretty much the entire Cape. And then over the bridge, so people that aren't familiar with when I say over the bridge, we have two primary bridges here on the Cape, the Bourne Bridge and the Sagamore Bridge. That brings you over to southeastern Massachusetts. They have particular areas that are also NSAs, but MassDEP is really focusing on the Cape right now.
So Jennifer, I want to ask you about the Cranberry Bog project.
Yeah, this is super exciting, Jeff. We do a lot of our work is in the Three Bays watershed, which is one of five watersheds in Barnstable. And this watershed has the Three Bays estuary. And the Marston's Mills River is a 4.5-mile river that flows through an 80-acre cranberry bog system that flows right through the system, through the Three Bays, and ultimately into the Nantucket Sound. So we had a great opportunity to purchase 64 acres of cranberry bogs just last year. And the purchase has happened last year, but we've been focusing on this cranberry bog system since 2021. And the importance of this system in the Marston's Mills River is that about a third of the nutrient load that's flowing into the Three Bays estuary is coming down this river and into the bay system. So with the support of a $1.3 million grant from the state of Massachusetts, we were able to purchase the cranberry bogs. And our goal is to turn these cranberry bogs into a natural wetland, back into their natural wetland state. We are currently in the design phase right now. This year, we'll go into permitting, and once permitting is completed, hopefully by early next year, we're going to start doing construction. Cranberry bog farming here in Massachusetts was very important as an economical source for many families since the mid-1800s. But as time has gone on, a lot of these cranberry bogs that have been with families for years and years and years has been a hardship for them. Farmers can't grow at a level that they can profit from it anymore. So a lot of these cranberry bogs are retired or left with no care at all. The cranberry bog system that we bought is for from a family that they're going to do a little bit of farming, but we're going to take the bogs that they sold to us and use them in a way that now we're going to have an environmental solution versus an economical solution from the cranberry bog system. So cranberries were, the way that farmers grew cranberries was they had to put layers and layers of sand over peat that was originally on their land. This allowed them to be able to grow and farm their cranberries. So as part of our restoration project, we actually have to remove multiple levels of sand off the land. And then the peat that's underneath, we anticipate that we're going to see seedlings grown that were from plants from hundreds of years ago. So we're really excited about that because we're going to really let the natural system treat the nitrogen load that's in the groundwater right now.
The positive thing about a wetland is that naturally it's going to slow the flow of water down. It's going to soak up a lot of those nutrients, a lot of the plant life, very diverse plant life. So you always have something going on there. You also have a lot of wildlife that is really interesting and feeds off of all of that plant life that lives there. So it's a very fun and diverse, you know, ecosystem that comes back up, and that can help with some of those nutrient issues that you're talking about.
Groundwater typically moves between 1 to 4 feet per day. So as you just said, we're looking to slow the flow of the water, and actually by having the flows slow down, we're going to actually see that the nutrients are going to slow as well and remove from the source.
Well, Jennifer, I really appreciate your time, and I appreciate you taking this part of your career to focus on clean water and all the work that you do in Cape Cod.
Right. Thanks, Jeff.
Erin Perry, Cape Cod Commission.
Well, Erin, thank you so much for joining me on the Clean Water Pod.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Erin, before we talk water quality and the Cape Cod, I want to talk about Erin. So where are you from? Where'd you grow up? Where'd you go to school? And how did you get into water quality?
Sure. So I actually grew up in Western Massachusetts. And I think for somebody who grew up in Western Massachusetts, I spent more time at the beach, around the ocean, than maybe most of my friends in that area. My father, he liked to dive recreationally. So he was a scuba diver. My mom loved snorkeling. They took us to the beach all the time. I had a friend whose family owned a house here in Yarmouth. They still do, and I still visit them out there, occasionally even today. So I spent some time here with her and her family, and I got to know the region a little bit. And as far as I can remember, I wanted to be a marine biologist. So I went to school at Rutgers University, which has a really great marine science program. And I loved it there, and I learned a lot about different types and kind of areas of marine science, physical oceanography, biological oceanography, chemical oceanography. And I got to learn through that experience that, maybe doing the science wasn't my thing. That's not where I wanted to focus my time moving forward. But I was really interested in what was happening in our coastal environments and how that science was used in policymaking and in management. And so I then went and got my master's degree in marine affairs at University of Rhode Island. And that program is really focused on coastal policy, on management of our coastal resources. And I was able to then transition to a position at the Cape Cod Commission, which, at the time was kind of an ideal role for me. Things kind of aligned. I married into a family too from Cape Cod, so they have a real connection here. My family now has a real connection here.
All right. So you say Western Massachusetts, like it's, 300 miles from the beach. And so let me just establish the geography a little bit of where we're talking about with Cape Cod and Massachusetts, because as a Midwesterner, I have to be honest with you, New England was always really difficult to discern where all the states were. But I know that talking with different New Englanders, that sometimes they think, well, that's two states over, which for a Midwesterner is like, not that far of a drive. So can we just lay out the New England geography a little bit, and where you're at and where Cape Cod sits?
Cape Cod is a peninsula off the eastern coast of Massachusetts. It's about 340 square miles. There are just two bridges that are utilized to access the region. And people come here, whether it's year-round residents or seasonal residents, for the natural resources. We are home to the Cape Cod National Seashore, which is a really well-known and critical resource for our region. We are also home to 53 different coastal embayments across the region. Those embayments and the land areas that contribute to those embayments comprise about 80% of our land area. So everything that happens in our region, all of the ways that we use our land, have an impact on those coastal embayments. And they're one of the most critical resources. They attract people here. We have, 586 miles of shoreline in the region. And there are, many, many different beaches that attract our year-round and our seasonal residents.
So the water quality issue is nitrogen influences on the water quality. Is there a total maximum daily load on the Cape?
Sure. So of the 53 embayments we have, many of them do have total maximum daily loads. So it's maybe different than, others might experience in other areas of the country where the watersheds are large. But on the Cape, again, we have 53 watersheds and they cover much smaller areas. So many of those, particularly along the south shore of the region, do have total maximum daily loads. Those south-facing coastal embayments are more vulnerable to the impacts of nitrogen, given that they have less tidal flushing than some of the areas along the Cape Cod Bay side or the north side of the region. And so those south-facing embayments are the ones that are really subject to those total maximum daily loads and are facing more vulnerability as a result of the nitrogen loading in the region.
Okay, explain tidal flushing.
Sure. And that's really about the exchange of water in an embayment. And so on the north side, we see, you know, many feet of tides on a kind of twice daily basis, whereas on the south side, we see much less than that, perhaps a couple feet, certainly varies by embayment, but it's about a half to a third of what they would see on the north side in terms of exchange of water.
So the hope is that, you know, we're with maybe not the hope, but the bigger tidal flush bring, you know, is able to pull that local water quality out into the ocean and dissolve into the vastness of the ocean, whereas you may not get as much of that if you don't have that tidal influence.
A bit. It certainly doesn't solve the problem, but it helps. And so, you know, on the south side, there's less of that exchange. And so that nitrogen loading really builds up in our estuaries.
In terms of the TMDLs, most of them have that you've have in the area, most of them are then focused on nitrogen.
Yes. The TMDLs for our coastal embayments are nitrogen related.
So then what, you know, the TMDLs obviously are going to describe the issue. They're going to describe, you know, the sources of the nitrogen. And, you know, we talked a little bit about septic systems. Are there any other major components? And what's kind of the breakdown with population influence through septics and other sources?
Sure. So the TMDLs tell us as well, you know, how much nitrogen we need to remove to meet water quality standards. Across the Cape, the average removal rate for septic nitrogen load through the work that we've done to establish those TMDLs exceeds 50% Cape-wide. So many of our embayments, we have to remove at least 50% of the nitrogen that is entering them. Septic systems are the primary source of nitrogen in the embayments on the Cape. They account for about 80 or so percent. But we also do have nitrogen loading from fertilizers, from stormwater runoff. There's certainly nitrogen loading from atmospheric deposition that, you know, is entering our embayments, but those are less, the atmospheric deposition and some of the other elements are less controllable than the nitrogen in the fertilizer and the stormwater runoff. So on the Cape, what we have been really focusing on and what our communities have been focusing on is that large source of nitrogen loading that comes from our septic systems.
I want to talk a little bit about atmospheric deposition is its own thing. You'll see that in a lot of TMDLs. It's usually a pretty small amount, and it is just, you know, it's background conditions. So not much you can do about that at a local level. In terms of the nitrogen load coming from fertilizer, you know, I assume you're talking about mostly residential lawns, commercial, you know, grassways, of course. You know, golf courses are always, you know, a landmass that are talked about in terms of those loading. And I know that that's not the biggest thing that you guys have going on there, but I want to focus on that a little bit because I think a lot of people, when I've been working water quality over the years, a lot of people say, well, what's the one thing that I can do? Like they're to kind of break it down. What is the one thing that I can do to make sure that I'm helping out with water quality? And here it seems like the residents have a significant influence. I mean, 10, 15, 20%, whatever that loading is, for what they can do to their lawn or not do to their lawn. Is that something that you guys have focused on? And what's the messaging around that to try to help with that aspect of the nitrogen loading?
Sure. That is something that our communities have focused on. You know, fertilizer accounts for, you know, roughly, we'll say 10%. It varies depending on the watershed of the nitrogen loading in a given embayment. And so communities have adopted local regulations. There's certainly a big effort to educate communities and residents as to what the nitrogen loading, you know, from fertilizer does to the surrounding embayments. It's hard to really measure the impact that kind of those diffuse opportunities where different, you know, residents are taking action on their lawns and what that impact is on the broader challenges that a given embayment faces. But many of our communities, again, have adopted local regulations to address some fertilizer use in their communities. They've also been taking on kind of those education and engagement campaigns to make sure that the people who live here or visit here understand the impact of that fertilizer use on the embayments.
Okay, so you know, how many communities are we talking about? And like, you know, where are we at in that process? Are we, you know, do we have plans for all of the communities, or are some of them still developing? You know, where would we say we're at in the planning process?
Sure. So we have 15 communities on the Cape. Some are relatively small with just maybe a few thousand year-round residents. And some are much larger in the 20 to 30,000 resident kind of range. And so each community is at a different place in the planning process. Many communities are moving forward with implementation. So of the 15 communities, we have, you know, just a few that are still really in the earlier phases of the planning process. We have seen a lot of success over the last few years. In part, that is due, you know, to the flexibility and the kind of changes that MassDEP, the Department of Environmental Protection, has made to its permitting strategy. So today, and this was a recommendation of the 208 plan, the state offers kind of a watershed permitting pathway where a community, rather than looking townwide at their wastewater infrastructure needs, can focus around the jurisdiction of the problem, which is really at the watershed scale. And so at the watershed scale, they're able to apply for these permits. The permits allow them to incorporate technologies aside from the typical collection and treatment, because we know in some of the locations across the region, given how spread out our development is, that other solutions might be better suited, might be more cost effective, at least to test out and pilot initially. And so those watershed permits allow communities to incorporate those non-traditional or less tested strategies and get credit for the impact that they're having on an embayment.
What community would you say is the furthest along in this process?
So several of our communities had, you know, some infrastructure prior to development of the 208 plan. So the towns of Barnstable and Provincetown and Chatham already had some existing sewer systems. They've continued to expand those sewer systems over the last many years. And so those communities are a bit more advanced on infrastructure implementation. But all of our communities on the Cape are really, you know, dedicated to taking action and are working through priorities for their communities and are moving forward with implementation. I will say that over the last several years, so one of the recommendations of the 208 plan was to develop an infrastructure fund. And so the Cape Cod and Islands Water Protection Fund was something that was established by the Massachusetts legislature in 2018. And one of the biggest issues that always comes up during, you know, development of the infrastructure plans in our communities is the cost. And so the Cape and Islands Water Protection Fund provides a 25% subsidy currently to all projects that advance to implementation and are listed on the Clean Water Intended Use Plan for the state revolving fund loans. And so that's a program offered at the state level to finance infrastructure investments for water quality purposes. So every project that moves forward through that process gets currently that 25% subsidy from the Cape and Islands Water Protection Fund. Prior to that fund being created, just a couple of our communities had applied for state revolving fund loans. Since establishment of that fund, 12 of our communities have been listed on the intended use plan and have received subsidies through the Cape and Islands Water Protection Fund. And so if that's any indication, I guess, of the progress that has been made over the past many years, we have now 12 communities advancing projects currently to address water quality issues in the embayments.
Okay, so you say communities are you know, applying to the state revolving fund, which is a great program that, you know, many, if not all, states have some version of. Maybe we can cover that in a future episode at some point. But I'm curious, like you say, the community applies for this money. So these are community projects, or are some communities taking this money and then their project is to upgrade residential septic systems redistribute that money or redirect that money on an individual level? Like, are these community-wide projects or down to the individual for septics, or both?
So currently they're both. Historically, the SRF program, the State Revolving Fund Loan Program, has financed, I would say, primarily centralized kind of collection and treatment facilities. Certainly that's been the history on the Cape. But over more recent years, since development of the 208 plan, we have seen projects, non-traditional projects, advance through that process. We've seen a, you know, a permeable reactive barrier, which is essentially a barrier that intercepts groundwater to remove nitrogen listed on the intended use plan. We've also seen an innovative alternative septic system program that would be kind of run by a municipality listed on the intended use plan as well. And so we do anticipate, you know, more of these non-traditional solutions being advanced through that program in the future. And the intent of that fund was to support not only that centralized infrastructure, that wastewater treatment facility and collection system type infrastructure, but those non-traditional strategies as well, based on community needs.
When we talk about a community that's a little further along in developing some of these plans, I'm curious, you know, in a specific watershed, have you seen implementation to the point where you have, you know, seen improvements in the water column? Any sort of water quality measurable improvements that you've seen with some of these communities that are maybe a little bit further along in their implementation?
You know, I think one of the things that came up through the 208 plan development was the fact that we need to have better access to the data that tells us how we're doing. And so a recommendation of the 208 plan was to develop a water quality monitoring kind of data portal and to ensure that we have consistent monitoring moving forward on an annual basis. And so over the course of the past many years, the Center for Coastal Studies has been monitoring stations in each of the embayments across the Cape so that we have that consistent data and information to measure progress. And then we've also developed a centralized water quality database and kind of user interface that provides some trend analyses so that as communities are taking actions in different watersheds, we can look at that water quality monitoring data and better understand the progress we're making and the impact of those actions. And so while it is kind of early, I think, to say whether or not we're seeing kind of market improvements in our water quality as a result of the infrastructure development and the different water quality projects, we do have kind of the infrastructure and the platforms established and the water quality monitoring established to be able to measure that in a more effective way moving forward. The other thing maybe I will say is that there are a couple of watersheds that are kind of collaboratively advancing strategies where we may, you know, see more improvements in the near term. And so we have, you know, the Pleasant Bay watershed, which is shared by four communities that is the home to the first state-issued watershed permit. And so those four communities all have plans that they have developed collaboratively to implement water quality and wastewater projects within that watershed. And they are kind of well on their way into, you know, development and implementation of those projects. And so that is a place that is a well-studied watershed and embayment and where we can, you know, continue to track water quality and better understand the impacts of that collaborative action. We also have the Three Bays Watershed in Barnstable, where both the town as well as some nonprofit organizations and the county and others have been engaged in different non-traditional projects to better understand, you know, what the impact of, you know, on-site septic systems, innovative and alternative on-site septic systems might have in the watershed, and are working on other kind of habitat restoration projects. And so that is another location where I think we can, you know, we can really perhaps see progress in a near term.
Okay, so these are always big questions because when you talk about, I want to see some progress in the near term, we talk about these long timelines for implementation. I mean, we've seen some really great examples in this podcast of some progress and some success, but you know the magnitude of some of these issues is quite large, and sometimes the time frames are, you know, measured in decades, not in years. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what is your current prediction of the time horizon that it'll take to try to address these issues with the current plans? You know, what are we talking about in terms of forecast?
Sure. So many of the plans are intended to be implemented over 20 or perhaps even longer time periods. Communities are certainly looking to advance them as quickly as they can. There's a clear sense of understanding and urgency to implement those plans, but it takes some time to develop that infrastructure. So that is actually a key reason why through the 208 plan, we had to look at a wide range of strategies. I think, you know, source reduction, with, you know, wastewater treatment collection systems takes a longer period of time in some instances to see the effect on the particular water body. But when you combine those with some strategies that maybe intercept groundwater, like permeable reactive barriers, where they could perhaps intercept groundwater and remove nitrogen from groundwater closer to the embayment, or couple those with, you know, strategies that really focus more on restoration and utilizing kind of nature-based solutions within an embayment to improve, you know, habitat and the quality of our waters. When you couple those strategies, you're likely to see some impacts far sooner than that 20-year kind of time horizon for the larger infrastructure projects. And so through the 208 plan, we really emphasize looking at this problem at the watershed scale and thinking about not only the source reduction strategies that could be used, but some of the other nature-based solutions or alternative strategies that could be used in the short term, even if at a pilot stage.
All right, so you mentioned the Water Protection Fund. So just tell me a little bit more about that. Where does that funding come from and what's that used for?
So the Water Protection Fund is a really kind of new and innovative way of helping to fund the wastewater infrastructure that we need here on the Cape. As I mentioned, it was established in 2018, and it was established with a dedicated source of revenue that comes from a 2.75% excise tax on short-term rentals. And so we talked a little bit about how we are a very seasonal community. We've got about 220,000 year-round residents, but that can increase, you know, threefold in the summer on any given day. And so we have a lot of people who come here on a short-term basis, whether it's to visit for a week or to use their second home. We've over a third of our housing units are second homes, and those may be rented out on a short-term basis and then used for part of the year. So there is an opportunity here to think about, you know, how we could tie a source of revenue to funding the wastewater infrastructure we need. The 2.75% excise tax is applied to all short-term and traditional short-term rentals and traditional lodging in the region, and that tax collected goes directly into the regional fund, the Cape Cod and Islands Water Protection Fund. All 15 Cape Cod communities are members of the Water Protection Fund, and so they are eligible to receive that subsidy, that essentially grant to fund the wastewater infrastructure that they advance through the state's Clean Water State Revolving Fund. And so, as I mentioned, that was developed in 2018. It began collecting revenues in 2019. And to date, the fund has awarded over $204 million in subsidies to Cape Cod projects. So it's a significant source of revenue that is tied directly to kind of the seasonal nature of our community and some of the reasons why we really need to build infrastructure that meets that peak kind of flow that we see in the summer that we wouldn't otherwise have to build if we weren't such a seasonal community.
Well, Aaron, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for all of your work in water quality in Cape Cod, and thank you so much for joining us on the Clean Water Pod.
Thanks so much for having me.
My name is Sarah Wigington. I work at the Massachusetts Alternative Septic System Test Center.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for joining us on the Clean Water Pod.
Thanks for having me.
I'm really excited to talk about what you guys are doing on Cape Cod, but I first want to talk about Sarah. So where did Sarah grow up? Where did you go to school? And how did you get interested in water quality?
So I grew up in South Central Kentucky, and I grew up with a creek in my backyard, and I grew up kayaking on the Green River. So I've always had a really deep appreciation for nature, specifically water. And I went to Western Kentucky University, and that's where I got my bachelor's degree. I got my bachelor's degree in biology and wasn't exactly sure what I wanted to do with that biology degree, but I did know I wanted to go to grad school and wanted to participate in research that was really applied. And what I mean by applied is that it could solve real problems. That's really what I've always been interested in, and with a water focus, solving real water quality problems. And so I took that into a master's and then a PhD at the University of Rhode Island. And then I met the folks at Massachusetts Alternative Septic System Test Center while I was doing my PhD. They actually funded my PhD work. And that's how I got introduced to all of the nitrogen issues on Cape Cod and all of the water quality issues on Cape Cod in general.
Okay. So this organization that you've mentioned, that is a mouthful. So let's talk about it a little bit. Let's talk about the history of that organization and the mission and what it's all about.
Sure. So I'll say it again. It's the Massachusetts Alternative Septic System Test Center. And it was established by Barnstable County government in the late 90s. So in the late 90s, it became really evident that nitrogen was a problem on Cape Cod. The coastal embayment started to become more and more polluted, having more and more algal blooms. And we knew that the problem was mainly septic systems. So manufacturers of septic systems, we call them IA, or Innovative and Advanced Septic Systems, kind of came on the market to say they, you know, we remove nitrogen from septic systems. And we exist, the test center exists to provide third-party verification for those manufacturer claims. So, you know, there's this technology that comes on the market and they say they remove all the nitrogen in the septic system water. We're here to prove that they actually do what they claim to do. And so we provide that third-party oversight. And we're, again, a part of Barnstable County government providing that as a certification and test center.
So in the Cape Cod watershed, a lot of the problems are around nutrients. And you guys have determined that nutrients are, you know, a significant percentage of the issue. So this is where a lot of this focus comes in, mainly due because you've got a lot of population that are in a pretty small land area that impacts the water that's directly adjacent to that population. In terms of like historically, what kind of septic systems were used and now what kind of septic systems are used and what is the advantage of upgrading to those newer systems?
So if we go pretty far back in history, we can sort of think of what we would consider non-acceptable forms of sewage disposal. So that would be like straight pipes that are just doing ground, surface application of septic effluent, which unfortunately still happens in our country and around the world. But Massachusetts, pretty forward thinking. They have the Title V regulation that started to protect human health is really the main focus of Title V. And so the idea is to get the sewage away from humans. So the first step towards that was what we call cesspools. It's really just a big pit really deep in the ground. And all of your septic system water would go into that cesspool that basically injects it into the groundwater when you put it that deep. But it does get away from humans and does protect human health, but it does not protect groundwater or any of our resources. So then in the mid-90s, I think 1995, there was a big rehaul of Title V. And that brought us more into what we call conventional septic systems that we have today. And these are really just PVC pipes, usually surrounded by crushed gravel and sand. And they are better than cesspools, but not a whole lot. So they remove more pathogens, you know, viruses and bacteria than a cesspool would. But they really don't do any better than a cesspool does on nitrogen and phosphorus and those nutrients that we worry about polluting our waterways. So that really brought us into the late 90s is when these IA, Innovative Alternative Septic Systems, started to come on the market. And those are really anything that do better treatment for septic system waste than a conventional system. So this could be a system that removes phosphorus, a system that removes even more pathogens than, you know, a normal system might. And then in Cape Cod, we really think about these nitrogen removing innovative alternative septic systems. There's actually been a couple generations of those. So when they first came on the market, they were being approved to get a certain, you know, level of treatment that really isn't adequate anymore. So we do have this next generation that are called enhanced innovative alternative systems. And these are really designed to remove almost all the nitrogen from the septic tank effluent. And when it's released back into the environment, it will have very, very little nitrogen. And the idea is that that will be protective of the environment, the coastal embayments.
I don't know that I have ever heard the term cesspool used as a technical term. I only heard it used euphemistically. So that's very interesting to hear it as a, like a technical definition that I'm not sure many of us have probably heard applied in that sense before. So that was great to hear. I'm curious in terms of implementation throughout the watershed. I mean, you guys would have a pretty good idea of how many of these septic systems are currently in place along, you know, inside the watershed. I'm sure there's a number, and you probably have a decent idea of how many have been upgraded to this you know, advanced technology. And I assume there's a goal associated with what percentage of the watershed you'd like to get to see the reductions that are needed.
Yeah. So in Massachusetts altogether, I think there are about 500,000 septic systems, and those are densely located on the coast. In each of the Cape Cod towns, there are thousands of septic systems. And they have been slow mostly to upgrade those to innovative alternative systems. A lot of those regulations have been local regulations. So that would be local towns, you know, requiring specific installations to have the innovative alternative systems. And then there has been some areas previously established by the state to be protective of mostly drinking water is really the several years ago, the requirement for some homeowners on the Cape to install these IA systems. But we have seen a big shift in these requirements and regulations with the new DEP regulations that are actually very new. They just came out last year, and they will require each town to make a plan to control the nitrogen in their watersheds. And most towns will focus largely on septic. That's going to be a really big part of the plan to control the nitrogen. So it will mean thousands and thousands of septic systems being replaced for enhanced innovative alternative systems.
So Sarah, I'm curious, like, how are homeowners adapting to these new rules? And is there any help from the county or from any organization to sort of get them to understand why these upgrades are important and how to do them?
Yeah, so in the past, these sorts of upgrades, if a homeowner was required to upgrade to an IA system, it's all on the homeowner's shoulders. Working through the permit process, working with the town, working with the state through their permit process, they basically have to do it all themselves. And this is creating a lot of, you know, issues for homeowners because they're not experts in this. And there's lots of regulatory jargon to understand when you're trying to go through this process. And knowing that so many new IA systems are going to be going in, it is really important to the county, specifically the wastewater division at the county, to support homeowners and the folks at the towns who are going to be creating these watershed management plans and implementing them. So the county, with funding from the Environmental Protection Agency, has created the Septic Utility Program. It's pretty unique. There has really only been like one or two other pilot tests of a utility program for septic systems. It's, of course, you know, really common to have utility programs for any other utility, sewer, electrical, anything, is going to have some central network managing those and taking a lot of the responsibility out of the homeowner's hands. And so that is the intention with our septic utility program. The SUP is what we're calling it. Again, it's brand new. It's a pilot through the EPA. And I think the EPA's hope is that we can create a pilot that they can replicate in other areas using the same sorts of technologies.
So, I mean, I need to ask, what's up?
What's up? That's what we ask. That's what we, what's up with SUP?
Yeah, there you go. Have you had any communication with homeowners? Like, how is this, is there a lot of interest in these upgrades? You know, are people coming forward and wanting to proactively get out ahead of this?
Yeah, I think that a lot of people are definitely looking forward to having more support at a regional county level. I think that the folks at the town are looking forward to having some support from us. And I definitely think homeowners are looking to us to be the experts for not only how these systems function, but how they interact with them from a homeowner's perspective. And so I think that for the most part, people realize that something needs to change, that we can't keep deteriorating our natural environments on the Cape, that will hurt Cape tourism. And I think that they are very glad that there is some support from the county level.
Now, you're not a native Cape Codder, but you now live and work there. What would you say the sense of identity is for the local residents to this particular water body, like, and the water bodies throughout the Cape? I understand it's not just Cape Cod. It's the little water bodies that are spread out throughout the Cape. that feed into this as well. Is this a community that really identifies with that local water body?
I would say definitely. Cape Codders are so passionate about water quality. So many of them either make their livelihood or, you know, use all of their free time by or near the water. And I do think that everyone realizes that the environment has been deteriorating, both, as you say, in the coastal embayments and the freshwater ponds, because we focus so much on nitrogen. But phosphorus is, you know, the problem in freshwater bodies. And there are a lot of freshwater ponds on Cape Cod that are starting to suffer, again, from septic, likely from the phosphorus from septic. So I do think, again, I think that everyone locally realizes something has to be done to save the life that everyone has built here. Because again, like you say, everyone is very passionate about the water in Cape Cod.
When you say ponds, how big are we talking about and what are those ponds used for?
So most of the ponds on Cape Cod are kettle ponds. So they're not really connected to anything, mostly not tidally connected. Some of them can be deep. Some of them aren't super deep. They're mostly used for recreating. I think people have an idea. I definitely did before I came to the Cape that everyone who's on the water in Cape Cod is coastal. They're on a sailboat. That is definitely not the case. If you drive around in the summer on the Cape, you'll see just as many people, probably mostly locals, by the freshwater ponds, not so much by the ocean.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because I think some people may associate the word ponds with something that's just, you know, very small, it's in somebody's backyard, you know, but these are, you know, a little bit bigger, but they're disconnected, mm-hmm. right? It's not a lake that's then draining into, you know, a bigger water body. It's not this giant thing, but it's substantial enough that people can maybe get out and do something with.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So Sarah, we've talked about septic systems before in other contexts. We had a whole episode in Montana that really focused on septics. Are there any other technologies, since you're at the organization that would know, are there any other technologies beyond the normal septic tank upgrades that we're talking about that are in consideration?
Yeah. So in addition to the enhanced innovative alternative systems, we have also been at the test center exploring what we call eco-sanitation or urine diversion. And that's an umbrella term for a lot of different types of technologies that all keep your waste out of the water in the first place. So this is like composting toilets, urine diverting fixtures, there's incinerating toilets. And these are a different paradigm and do take, you know, some communication to, you know, assure people that the adoption is actually not that different than a regular flush toilet. But once you sort of get over the idea that you're not going to have a flush toilet, it does open a venue to really effectively manage nutrients. There's lots of advantages to not putting your waste into water. It takes a lot of energy to transport waste once it's in water because water is very heavy. Obviously, you've contaminated clean water by defecating and urinating in it. And, you know, we can reuse nutrients that are in our excrement for lots of useful things, especially urine. Urine is absolutely packed with most of the phosphorus and the nitrogen that goes through the waste stream. So if we can keep it out of the water in the first place, that's really efficient for both people trying to clean up the water and for people thinking about how they're going to fertilize not just gardens, but, you know, cropland. So we're thinking about some sort of paradigm where we can set ourselves up as we're calling it a urine depot. And we've actually had the town of Falmouth on the Cape start working with us towards a pilot program to see how we can, at a community scale, divert and collect urine, pasteurize it, and then again, maybe make a useful end product that we can then sell. And again, right now, taking care of your waste is pretty expensive, but we are really envisioning a future where maybe one day somebody comes to your house and gives you a check and then collects your urine. So that's, you know, kind of out there, but it's not outside of the realm of possibility.
I'm fascinated. I'm curious what the initial reception is from people to want to adopt these technologies. Are there Is there a lot of interest, or are most people kind of like, no, thank you?
Surprisingly, there is a lot of interest in urine diversion, especially here on the Cape. It's partially because there are already communities here who are very invested in protecting the environment and doing everything they can personally. And urine diversion is not a super difficult thing to start doing to, you know, immediately impact the water quality around you. So for that, there's lots of people already interested. And then the regulations that are coming down from the state to upgrade systems, that's going to be a quite expensive process for towns and homeowners. And we think that there is a path forward for urine diversion and eco-sanitation that could potentially be a lot more economically advantageous for homeowners upgrading. That is going to take some work with regulators, because right now it's not a super direct path forward, as it is with the EIA, so the innovative alternative systems, that's a very clear path forward. There's just more to work out with the urine diversion, mostly because the end product that you have when you're doing eco-sanitation is very dense with nutrients, and potentially, you know, contaminated with pathogens. So there's got to be treatment. And there's just a couple of regulatory bodies in Massachusetts that need to feel comfortable with the process before we're able to, you know, offer it widely.
You know, the other question that came to mind when you started talking about that was, you know, the things that are in our waste, right? So, I mean, you mentioned pathogens. I'm also thinking about like pharmaceuticals, and I'm thinking about caffeine and things like that. Are those challenges that are yet to be figured out in terms of how you separate those to make a useful product, or is that pretty much taken care of in the science at this point?
Yeah. So the Rich Earth Institute in Brattleboro, Vermont, has done a good amount of work on testing their pasteurized urine for pharmaceuticals and other contaminants of emerging concern. And there's not much that is left in the urine after certain processing. It's something that we are really interested in looking into, not just pharmaceuticals, but PFAS is a big one that everyone is really interested in now. You know, it's not something that we think about for what we're putting into the groundwater. They're there for sure in all of our waste. And I think whatever solution we can potentially come up with for treating these contaminants of emerging concern from the waste stream will also translate really well to any urine reclaimed.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for sharing some of this research and all of the work that you've been doing up in Massachusetts and the Cape Cod area. And thanks so much for joining us on the Clean Water Pod.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, that's it for episode 6. Join us next month for episode 7 as we head out to New Mexico. If you have any questions about this or future episodes, please get in touch. You can find us on Twitter at CleanWaterPod or send me an email at cleanwaterpod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you, what questions you have, and what you'd like to hear on the pod. Until next time, thanks for listening.